My name is Janet Anderson, and this is the third session in a loosely grouped group of five called Creativity and Chaos. And I wanted to start off just a little bit about talking about what we did in the first one and the second one before we moved into three, because last night a weird thing happened. I think it was because I was tired, but I felt when I left I was fuzzy, and I was hoping that everybody else wasn't as fuzzy as I was feeling. In the first session, we talked a little bit about boredom and dis-ease, and how, in fact, there are different kinds of boredom and so on and so forth, but this was sort of not the simple kind of boredom when you're in a lecture and you're bored and you get up and walk out. I mean, it's one that you can handle and discard. It's more the using boredom in the language of the void or the hole or the blahness that sometimes comes in one's life. And we talked a lot about what could be the causes of that and so on. But the main thing, I suppose, that would come out of that would be so many times in our society when we start to feel that feeling, we become afraid of it because we're not supposed to have it, and therefore we do something. We get busy, busy, busy. Consequently, we never find out what is causing this malaise. And as far as creativity goes, one needs to almost embrace, one of the persons used that word, almost embrace that boredom, finding out of themselves what's causing it, so that creativity and their in a sense, their image of God can come out. So do something is often premature handling for boredom. The way to handle it is often to do nothing. To not even try to do something so that you can find out who you are in relationship. Because it could be many reasons. You know, there could be many boundaries that you've put up that aren't necessarily needed. It could be anger. It could be, you know, displacement. Many, many different reasons. Each person is different. So that was sort of where we focused on Monday. And then last night it was on learning to see. And I think that's a little more difficult. It's hard for me to even talk about it because it's like saying we all do it, and yet none of us do. I mean, we all can see, and yet how many of us really pause to really see deeper than just cataloging it and going on? And so one of the songs that came into my head dates me. But you remember the song, Stop in the Name of Love, da 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 da. That phrase came into my mind in the idea of love as God is love, and in the name of God, stop and really see, really use who you are and find out who you are in relationship to what you actually visually see. So, and another thing we talked a little bit about is seeing is work, that you don't just see. It's like learning to walk, it's learning to talk, it's learning anything. We don't often put the work into it because it comes so easily. And then I think the difficult part came when we started to talk about that in one sense, especially since I'm sort of a visual person, the idea that through disciplined seeing, the artist actually penetrates through seeing into idea or into something more than what they are looking at. We use this painting a little bit. There's a painting in the library that he painted about, I think it's Eucharist over Nagasaki. And which gives a person a lot of clues. It's nice sometimes when the artist entitles their work and helps you to see them a little bit more. But in a sense, by disciplining oneself in the seeing, I'm talking from my own life, that there's a touch of something that is exciting that in a sense religious study or belief also touches. And I used a quote where in fact the symbols of talking about the mystery of life, and if you're Christian, you'd say God, that is sometimes the touch that artists are are striving for. Not all artists, of course, use that same language, and a lot of them would be angry if you put that on them. But I believe that. I really think that there's something special about being human and seeing. And another point was about our projections. We had Charles let stand up here and see him as different people. That our projections or expectations about people often limit our perceptions because we're projecting things onto them by what we assume for their position and so on. So, and I don't know if I did this last night, I can't remember, that I wanted to suggest this book by Annie Dillard, Teaching a Stone to Talk in Relationship to Seeing. I'm going to use a little today, too. And she also wrote Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. I brought that along. The bookstore also has that. She's more of a naturalist viewer. I mean, she sits and watches water, you know, but she touches something greater because of who she is by her seeing. So she's a real interesting person to read. Then, of course, there's Lewis Thomas, Lives. This is also in the bookstore. Lives of a Cell. He also did The Medusa and the Snail. He's an observer that just looks and then reflects in relationship to his looking, and consequently has developed quite an art, a talent of doing it. So these two people in relation to that, and I don't remember if I suggested that or not. So that was last night, and so if you walked away a little fuzzy, you weren't the only one. I hope that a lot of the things that were said were clearer than I was feeling at the end of the evening. Sometimes, because of who I am, I think faster than I could talk, and I jump, you know, and leave spots out, and someone listening might not catch the jump. So. Anyway, so if you have any questions about that, please, we could talk about it today. Okay, today I wanted to talk about prophet as artist, artist as prophet. Now, before anyone asks this question, I want to say there are no equal signs up there. I'm talking about a life posture. I'm talking about how one lives one's life. I'm not saying that all prophets are artists, although some were. I'm not saying that all that prophets are artists are prophets, although I believe some are. I think I have that as a comparison more because we here at Holden have a reason of coming together that is based in Christianity. And at the same time, I am coming here as a visual artist, and my background has struggled with these two parts, my belief side and also my visual side. And so that's some of that that's going on. I do think there are some very obvious connections. So now, what I'd like us to do just for a minute is write down up here some of the things that you, when you think of a prophet, I would like you to think about not just you know, specifically what they did, like Jonah ran away or whatever, but what kind of person is a prophet? What are some of the things in their living out their life that made them a prophet or makes them a prophet? Can you think of anything off the top of your head? Just throw them in and I'll write them down.
Jane? Well, like the Old Testament prophets, a direct personal relationship with God.
Do you mind if I use my shorthand?
Mm-hmm. Which came to my think of, I don't know how to express it, a second sight, a second hearing. There ought to be a better word than second, but I don't know what it is.
Fools. And seen as fools.
I think broadly, both time-wise and three or four dimensionally.
Okay. Non-linear thinkers or broadly?
Non-sequential.
Yeah. Oh, I can't spell that. non-sequential.
You're a prophet, not a sinner.
Anyway, it's a, or,
they skip boxes once more.
Okay. Okay, anyone else?
Wild.
Wild?
Outsider.
Anything else?
Up beside direct personal relationship with God is a sense of having a call. Maybe that's the same thing.
Yeah, I think there was a sense of them, the people they spoke to also knew what they were talking about. I mean, they, when they called the people, in a sense, they were, the people had broken the covenant or an agreement, and they're saying, wait a minute, you know, there's something here that y'all are forgetting. I don't know how to say that, but it probably relates to this.
They saw things as they were, and were outspoken in it.
Okay.
They didn't necessarily like their work.
Not me.
I mean, they weren't particularly tied up with comfort as a way of life. Otherwise, they'd have never done it.
Okay. Anything else?
The way they saw things was not the way a lot of people see things, if that is the same as the bottom line. It, you know, it was, they saw the world, differently.
Perspective.
That's probably what I meant by second sight and hearing. And they saw and heard things that we do not.
Joan, I mentioned because as a reluctant.
Yeah.
And you said,
Moses too.
Forget it, I'm not doing that.
Moses too. Yeah.
Well, a lot of people. Okay, I think as we talk, if you come up with another one, you know, just say it and we'll add it. Because I think one of the things we often do is not realize that the prophets in the Bible were people. And they were in an historical context just as we are people and in an historical context. And they probably had a lot of the problems with their calling or the direct personal relationship with God as we do, and a lot of struggles. It's one thing history seems to do is sort of knock off those edges and sort of bring that person to, well, almost an inhuman statement. I mean, I'm wondering what's going to happen to Martin Luther King through history. You know,
put him on a pedestal that they weren't necessarily doing.
Yeah. It was their constant striving and their constant doing and their constant response to their call, but they weren't
personalized, or some of them that, oh, I agree.
Yeah. It, one of the things I wanted to do with that in front of us is I wanted to take three women and quote from them. Ann Truitt is a sculptor painter in Maryland, and this is a journal. And Mae Sarton is a poet novelist, and this is a journal of solitude. And Annie Dillard is a poet essayist, sort of scientific observer. And I sort of wanted to just use some of their words in relationship to what it means to them to be an artist. And with these always in front of us, maybe some, just that little juxtaposition will pull our minds together as far as what does it really mean to live the life of a prophet or an artist? And how do we live our lives? As I suppose you could say, as prophets and artists. First, I want to take Anne Truitt. She studied to be a psychologist and then changed. And I'll start with page 26. Okay, one of the things that being an artist is, that is not special to being an artist, is balancing intuition and the sensory info you get, you know, into your life, the intuitions you have in the senses, and or knowledge and your sensitivity. I mean, you're constantly stepping back and forth between what you learn and what you feel and what you intuit and what you you hear, see, and so on. You're constantly having this input and stepping back and forth. But the thing that makes an artist, and I feel a prophet, special is sort of the uniqueness. I'm saying this because I agree with her here, that is the uniqueness to in the degree to which these balances are crucial. To constantly be working with all of this, not focusing only on knowledge and not focusing only on sensory info, but this constant back and forth. And it's part of what creates and helps a person be a prophet, be an artist. Their essential effort is to catapult themselves wholly, without holding back one bit, into a course of action without having any idea where they will end up. They are like riders who gallop into the night, eagerly leaning on their horse's neck, peering into a blinding rain, and they have to do it over and over again. When they find that they have ridden and ridden, maybe for years, full tilt, in what is for them a mistaken direction, they must unearth within themselves some readiness to turn direction and gallop off again. They may spend a little time scraping off the mud, resting the horse, having a hot bath, laughing and sitting in candlelight with friends, but in the back of their minds, they never forget that the dark driving run is theirs to make again. They need their balance in order to support their risks. The more they develop an understanding of all their experience, the more it is at their command, the more they carry with them into the whistling wind. There seems to be a law that the more conscious knowledge you develop, the more you can expand your consciousness. The artist takes advantage of this law. Wise artists like Titian and Rembrandt and Matisse became greater as they became older.
Yeah, you need a separate one for each.
This is from July 6th, 19th. It's from her journal where she's writing about artists. And when I read that, especially the part about doing it over and over again, and full tilt, all out, and in a mistaken direction, I of course thought of Saul and Paul. You know, in one sense, what kind of guts does that take? And yet it's part of being an artist all the time. It's part of being a prophet. You are trusting the direction you're trusting. Something that you feel is right. Did any of you go to the Bible study this morning, Daniel Landers? I was sitting up there and saying, wow, this is exactly what I'm trying to touch on. The fact that an artist and the prophet is in some way tapping into this unity, this statement against disunity in the world, and who knows how, but it seems to be part of it. And oftentimes one can feel that in viewing a painting or listening to some music or seeing a drama, and you can't verbally say why you feel there's an attachment, but you can feel the attachment. One of her groups of people that are heroes to her, sort of, or people she's taken, these are the Greek poets. And here's a paragraph that she writes. The Greek poets saw and felt and then wrote. They learned from suffering. And the way they learned was to make the effort to articulate their personal experience into forms that transcended it. That's the part. Articulate their personal experience into forms that transcended it. They combined examined experience with the discipline of art to bring forth a statement forever useful to their fellow human beings. It was their solution to the problem of universal pain that struck me, not the direct alleviation which I was pursuing so hotly in my study of psychology, but a way that beckoned people toward aspiration. And I feel, isn't that what the prophet was doing, or the prophet does do? And in, I feel that's what the artist is also doing. That we don't often understand. Like, she does very abstract color columns and things that are very minimal. And it's like someone is almost speaking another language, and we're just catching glimpses of feelings. And it's hard to relate to someone who is living in a visual world when we're so verbal. But anyway, and then there's one other thing I wanted to read from her, page 178. Okay. The most demanding part of living a lifetime as an artist is the strict discipline of forcing oneself to work steadfastly along the nerve of one's own most intimate sensitivity. As in any profession, facility develops. I notice with interest that my hand is more deft, lighter, as I grow more experienced. But I find that I have to resist the temptation to fall into the same kind of pleasurable relaxation I once enjoyed with clay. I have, in some subtle sense, to fight my hand if I am to grow along the reaches of my nerve. Now, to me, if I were going to translate that, on the first night we were talking about something within ourselves. In a sense, if we believe we are created in the image of God, and if we truly believe that there is a concept of active spirit, then she's not using the same language. But in a sense, when she's talking about following her nerve instead of getting involved with just the facility of her hand, this is part of what I was trying to talk about before, touching within our own selves. I don't know if any of you hear that in there, but I certainly did. And it's part of assuming that people... Now I'm going to say this two ways. One, if it's a belief statement, you're saying that people have God within them and they can touch God within their own life. But I also feel that people may not believe that, and yet they are still capable of touching God within their lives. Does this make sense to you? That one of the things that we forget is that because we may need to express or find that within ourselves through our belief, some people maybe can find it without same belief we have, but our message would be to say, hey, you know, isn't this exciting? You know, this is actually what you're touching. And I'm not sure I used this image before, but I'm going to use it again if I did. I was at the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco. Did I talk about this? Clifford, there's a Clifford Still retrospective. I don't know if any of you know him. He's a very abstract painter and a very eccentric person. He's just a real character. But it happened that David and I were there on a weekday and hardly anyone was there. And because he's a major artist, they had given him a huge room. Actually, there were three rooms, but one was a huge room. And I've liked his work, but I had never seen it firsthand. And he works huge canvases. And they're mainly just color, mainly vertical, painted vertically like this. And there were a few that were deep purples and blacks and very turbulent and so on. But I came to this one, and it had to be like 10 feet by 8 feet. It was just mammoth. And I wasn't trying to discard his work. I wasn't trying to examine his work. I was just there to experience his work. And I came to this one, and there was no paint on the canvas except for three sort of golden orange bursts in one left lower left section, two grouped together and one sort of separate. And I don't know what happened, but I felt such intense joy for from that work. I had to sit down. I mean, you still tear me up. But it was something that he, I don't know if he knew what kind of conduit he was, but there was so much joy in that painting to me that it just still gives me shivers. Now, what was he touching? Because I am a Christian, I feel he was touching something holy through his work. But I had to go in with openness. I had to go in and accept his effort in his life rather than going in and saying, what is this fool doing? Or just not even being in relationship to him. Okay. One of the things that, to me, she says that, this is very good, but this is not in the bookstore. I just happened across this. Well, actually, David happened across it and says, do you know this? And it's the kind of book you pick up and you say, oh, I wish I'd written this. Anyway, it's put out by Penguin, so if you happen across it sometime, you may want to read it. She's talking about getting some idea of how to think without hardening our thoughts in the process. Okay, now that's sort of an interesting concept when we think about belief statements and symbols and life processes. Getting an idea of how to think without hardening the thoughts in the process of thinking them. So it's continuing to grow and continuing to create and continuing to participate in something that's more than ourselves.
What's her name?
Anne Truitt, T-R-U-I-T-T. She teaches art at the University of Maryland. One of the things that's in there and also in my own life that's very difficult, I think, to accept but is essential to creativity is the knowledge that stability never stays. Or in some senses, you could almost say stability never occurs. It's sort of learning to live with change, that you can have security for a while, but you have to continue to grow. Therefore, we accept that in youth and in children, there's change and excitement and so on, but it's sort of like when you get to be adult, you know, we stop. And in fact, as human beings, we're called to continue to change, continue to grow, to, in a sense, continue the growth of this force that is life. So the other person here, Mae Sarton, she's an East Coast writer. I don't know her poetry too well. I know her mainly through novels and then this Journal of a Solitude. The essays in here, I just keep rereading. I mean, I'll pick it up and I have many underlines in it and it just, it's the kind of thing where I say, oh yes, that could speak to me again. So anyway, I want to point her out to you. There are two books by her in the bookstore, in her novels and her poems and so on. Who she is as a person and what she's struggling with her beliefs, are in the story. So there are two over there. Okay. Now, let's see, first Mae Sarton, page 67. Okay. It is only when we can believe that we are creating the soul that life has any meaning. But when we can believe it, and I do and always have, then there is nothing we do that is without meaning, and nothing that we suffer that does not hold the seed of creation in it. And two more. This is kind of long, so I'll try to space it as I read it. My own belief is that one regards oneself, if one is a serious writer, as an instrument for experiencing. Life, all of it, flows through this instrument and is distilled through it into works of art. How one lives as a private person is intimately bound into the work. And at some point, I believe one has to stop holding back for fear of alienating some imaginary reader or real relative or friend and come out with personal truth. If we are to understand the human condition And if we are to accept ourselves in all the complexity, self-doubt, extravagance of feeling, guilt, joy, the slow freeing of the self to its full capacity for action and creation, both as human being and as artist, we have to know all we can about each other, and we have to be willing to go naked. One of the things Judy Madison does, when I noticed, I've heard her twice on her poet's journey, is she talks about reading her poems. She gets halfway through, she gets sort of embarrassed. I think that's really true. It's like, in a sense, your poems, I think, I'm not a novelist, but I would assume it'd be the same with a book. I know a couple people who write novels. And even with my own artwork, once it's out there, I almost have to divorce myself from it because it's too close. I've been so deeply involved with this piece of work that I don't want to be that vulnerable when someone else comes to relate to this piece of work. And so it's really a very daring thing for her to do, to open it up and say, okay, I'm reading this. Because it is part of her. I mean, that's why I would interpret it, because that's the way I feel. And I think, though, that that is essential, that we all must do that to be fully human, that we all must allow ourselves to be seen by others with all our flaws and positive things. And there again, that goes along with the whole thing of person in the image of God, and if the Spirit is active and so on, is how we view ourselves. And I'm doing a lot of talking right now, so if you have any questions, just feel free to punch in. And I realize I haven't set it up quite as much this time to be talking, but do something like break in or nod your head or something if you want to say.
Do you have any sort of private ritual or preparation or physical stance or place you go or any way to get yourself ready for this creative process that you're aware of?
No. I'd say no and yes at the same time. I was talking to this person, Gifford Myers, who's an artist in California, and we were at an art show opening, and I'd said I was finally going to try to be full-time in my studio. I've always done art on the edges of things and had excuses, you know, and I was finally going to try to be full-time, and I've never been able to do it. And he said to me, if you just go and sit in your studio and do nothing, that's a start. And I think that's part of it. It's partly sitting there waiting.
The discipline.
Yeah. It's partly knowing that something is going to come and not forcing it. Because if I go into the studio and I begin to work on something and I'm not totally there, the piece is shallow. If I go in to the studio and somehow it starts to flow, then I get inspiration from the piece. I mean, it becomes a dialogue. It's very simple, but it's very difficult, I think. I think it's hard. I think the hardest thing for me to do in my life is to wait, as David knows. I'm a terrible waiter. I just want something to happen now, you know. And yet, I think one has to, well, there's a long time ago, there's a book called Don't Push the River, which I haven't read it, but the image to me is one of knowing where one is and then trusting who one is.
Have you ever read The Origin of Consciousness in the Bicameral Mind?
I started that. And I started to read it when it was hardback. I said, I want to buy this when this is paperback. And then I stopped. So
it's not a book to get into, but it's worth going through.
Yeah, when I started this is something I need to read. And but like I said, I wasn't going to pay them. I was going to wait until pay her back. And then I just never got to do it. Did you have your hand up?
Don't you have to push sometimes to start the idea of going? Sometimes you have to discipline yourself to get something started.
Yeah, that's a good question, because there again, I want to say yes and no. Sometimes you can push at the wrong time. It's like saying,
you don't
I need an idea, therefore, blah, 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 blah. I think I get more ideas when I'm not pushing for the idea. Yeah. Does that, did you want to tag on to that?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Richard Foster, in Celebration of Discipline, talks about using the disciplines, not in and of themselves to be disciplined, but the disciplines put us in the position of being open to God so that God can work through us and come to us and speak to us. And I want, if that's what the waiting is, I mean, like any of the disciplines, the spiritual disciplines that he's talking about, they are not ends in themselves at all. They are not to make me more disciplined. They are to you know, get me in that place where God then is more, you know, in a more open place, or a place where God then is, you know, can come to me more easily. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, like, if waiting or...
Yeah, see, it's not like going and sitting in nowhere and waiting. I mean, I have a very specific... I mean, I'm an organizer. So if I don't have anything that's going, you know, I'll go and label all the boxes, and I'll clean up this corner, and then I'll have all the paper organized by size, and I'm always doing that. So, I mean, it's like the space is there. And I'm also a collector, so I'm always out finding things or seeing things, and I also collect thoughts and things. So it's like I'm not just sitting still waiting. It's a more a mentality of openness than or actively listening, or, you know... So, but also, I wanted to say, yeah, but there is a discipline side to it too, of course. And one of the things, I don't know your name.
Marilyn.
She talked about yesterday about seeing the image, and then there's the discipline of writing it and so on. And that is really true. There's definitely carrying it through. I mean, any prophet, of course, you get the inspiration or whatever, but you it's carrying it through and going on. But the exciting part is if you are before an artwork, I mean before the process of doing the artwork, it often seems more difficult than when you're involved in it. I mean, example, I had never done a piece that was bigger than like 8 feet, you know, freestanding. And so I was on Melrose in Los Angeles, and I saw these fantastic pieces of styrofoam that someone had thrown out of, I guess they'd been icebergs or something in some window display, and they were just strewn on the sidewalk. And I saw them, and I immediately said, oh, I wonder if I could have those. So I went over, and I they said, I'll be back, and I came back, and they'd already thrown them away, so I had to go through the garbage can and get these chunks. Just a second. And the thing was, I don't know why I picked those up, other than I thought those would be neat. And then I thought, I want to do this as a discipline because I have never done something this large. But in the process of doing it, the piece itself took on life, and I only responded to what it was. But I could, this is the hard part, the discipline of finishing it. I worked and worked and worked because there was one part that never came together, and so I had to actually add a piece and then bring that up to be equal with the others and so on, because once I became visually and emotionally and involved with this work back and forth, I did have a sense of finishedness that I was striving for. Okay, what?
Me?
Yeah.
Do prophets or artists go through people's trash?
I also like archaeology, so maybe that's why.
What did you do with styrofoam?
Oh, well, that's basically what I work with now, is styrofoam and latex house paint. And I create freestanding, organic-feeling shapes that are out of trash or, things people throw away, I guess. Discarded paint.
Call it garbage.
Yeah, right. So.
Do you bring any slides of your work?
No, I have a few, but they're mainly older ones. Yeah, I have a few.
Oh, then you're art. You're not an artist like this.
I used to be a painter.
Oh, well.
I mean, a painter on flat surfaces.
Okay. I think you can.
I'm still a painter. I'm just on three-dimensional surfaces.
Some of her work is very similar to that. Huh?
Yeah, I would say about 10 years ago I was painting very similar to this, only with a more paint on the canvas, but using the same juxtaposition of shape and to have forces in the lines between them.
Kind of modern.
Yeah, it started out being more realistic.
Like with our artists, like musicians, do you have your technical side that you gotta do first? But I think you answered it, because all this is preparation. All this is the technical side. This isn't the, you're like a musician who's gonna learn a song.
Oh, sure. The problem, that's the thing, that's a very good point.
Hours and hours and hours of exercise. And maybe you spend years learning the song before you really can create it.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point, because I think one of the things that artists can do, just like anyone else, is get so involved with the knowledge of the technique that becomes their process, rather than allowing themselves to continue to create. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Okay. What was I going to say? So that you can create and express something. I mean, as a singer, you can get so involved in the technical aspect, so that you put every note in the right place. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a skill, too. I mean, first of all, you have
right.
to learn, the notes, and the rhythms, the intervals and all of that, the harmony, that's just a skill. And then you have to put it in your voice technically so that, you're working with your body and it's, everything is sitting mm-hmm. in the right place. And then you go to a coach and they say, okay, that's fine, but that's very boring.
Yeah,
You've done your homework. Now you have to express something. Sometimes that can take years. I'm sure as a painter, I know nothing about painting, mm-hmm. but I would imagine if I were to take an art course to learn, even the first level, that I'd have to learn, what kind of brushes make this kind of a look, and what kind of
well, that's helpful.
And that's technical. That's technical stuff.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm also saying though that a person can create and know that joy of creating without knowing all those technical things. Mm-hmm. But if you love what you're doing, you're mm-hmm. learning. You're going to learn some of that too.
You can do that as a singer too. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to be a perfect technician to like to sing. Mm-hmm. How could people sing in camp songs and really love to sing? I mean, you don't even have to sing in tune.
Right. Right.
Or on pitch to love to sing. Right.
I'm thinking this discussion about the difference between the technique and the creativity, or the may say something about I used to categorize people by over here we had the people who had nothing to say and no way to say it. Over here you have people who have something to say and a way to say it, and then you have
everybody
combinations of that. Seems to me that an artist is perhaps one, or a prophet perhaps one that rises above that on occasion rises above the abilities that seem mm-hmm. to be there all the time. I'm thinking specifically of prophet here, but maybe those pieces of art that turn out to be that which is labeled as inspired, whatever, mm-hmm. means that on occasion that one rises above one's natural ability. And you have to be able to say, well, what causes that? When the prophet would say, God gave me this to say.
Uh-huh. And also, along with what you're saying, is that I feel each person can, in a sense, see in a mirror dimly. That in that there are flickers or lights or something happens, it may be brief, but...
Yeah, even the person that has nothing to say and no way to say it sometimes gets something
yeah.
to say in some ways.
One of the things that Anne says in here that I have felt is once you have had the full joy of this creation of something that, it's hard to explain, that it's really hard to go back and see your creativity dribbled away. Because mm-hmm. you can dribble things away, and in sense, she's saying, I have to remain an artist because I know this joy and I want to feel it again. I felt it a little and I want to feel it more. It's almost like an addiction of saying, I touched it, I want to touch it again.
Which means that you have to be willing to be insecure.
Definitely. That's where the chaos part. You're living constantly. I think one of the things in here that is really important is assuming that change is something that is always there, that you can't strive for the security. You have to strive to live as openly and honestly and with as much hope and as you can in your life with your creativity being your process. Is that making any sense?
I was wondering, you're talking about the feeling of success when you finish. Do you ever start anything that you don't finish?
Definitely.
Then where do you end up?
It's so hard to throw them away, though, because I put so many hours. But then Georgia O'Keeffe did a fantastic thing. When she had created, she was 30-something, and she went to a show, and she saw all her work, and she said, it's all trash. She took it, when the show was over, she threw it in a garbage can, everything, and began again. And I thought, what?
Guts.
So every once in a while, when I have a piece that I know I should throw away, I think, oh, she threw a whole bunch, just one. And just this habit with our last move, because I create these odd things, we have a lot to move. And there was one I did recently that I kept for a long time, but I threw it away because I wasn't exactly sure why I was doing it other than expressing anger. And I didn't feel it was a piece that could stand on its own. It was an image of a patriarchal God in a sort of a box with lays and gold and so on. And there was so much going on in that process that I was so involved emotionally with it that I couldn't bring it to any kind of fruition. So it was time to throw it away and start again. So, yeah, and there are things that just don't go, you know. It just
needed somebody to invent inflatable hysterical.
Yeah, yeah, they get put down.
Well, have you ever had the experience on the other side of the coin of finishing something and coming back to it the next day and thinking, did I really do that?
Oh, that, see, that's part of the joy. That's part of the excitement of saying, I participated in creation. I participated in something greater than myself. I couldn't have done that by myself. So yeah, and that's part of you, what you get addicted to, I think, when you get involved with creativity. Whatever field you're in. And when, you know, you start to feel not having headed for a while, it's sort of like, hey, I want my creativity fix here. I gotta go. No, that's very crassly put, but yeah.
Do you ever give David a chance to talk about creativity and chaos in your life?
Yeah, he's a writer. And so we talk a lot about creativity. In fact, he probably could have given a better lecture on this than me, because he's a verbal person.
A friend of mine who's a writer, successful, I think anybody who's published is successful, said that when he really has to force himself to get started. He has to sharpen 19 pencils.
Yeah. Move the papers. And
but he forces himself to get the first word on that paper from the typewriter. But he says, but when he finishes, he doesn't stop. He goes right straight through and rewrites the first chapter.
Hmm.
And he said it works.
You know, it's each person has their own way of doing it.
Every person, every writer that I associate with a guild, writer's guild, and everyone has their own special way of getting started and doing it and finishing or tearing off their hair or whatever they do in the process. And I had a very different way of writing before I had my family, okay, than I do now, where I have, when a 2.5-year-old, I have to really squeeze time in. And I have to be very disciplined with my time. And there are times when I write and I start because I have a project I know I have to work on. I have assignments from publishers and from film. And those are all deadline things that you have to work to. And sometimes that helps creativity, and other times it stunts it because you know you have to really move on this one because it's 2 weeks away. But I go and I sift through those projects, and sometimes I just can't deal with one. It's like walking in glue. You cannot. And I
always work on 2 or 3 things at a time.
And then I shift that one aside and go try with something else. And it usually comes back. And sometimes even if I've worked on one really hard and it really seems to be coming, my preference is to leave it for a few days, because then you can come back and you can see all the holes in it and you think, oh, yuck. Or else you can come back and you say, hey, wow, like you said, did I do that? Did I write that?
Yeah.
And it works. But you need that. For
that beginning thing, yeah. I think, especially when I was working on stretched canvases, that is so white and so empty that it's so powerful that I would not look at it. I would make a mark on it to, in a sense, destroy its power, I suppose, and begin a dialogue. I don't know what I was doing, but once I put something on there that I could erase or move or something, then it was beginning. But to start, sometimes it's really hard. And I often just will do something without thinking to begin and then work from what I've been doing.
I wondered if this theory of, well, the creative juices are flowing, to go full circle and go right through the first chapter, if there's any way you could do that with the visual arts, like if you have a painting that you're not really satisfied with,
it depends on sometimes you can overwork and it's best, you know, to walk away and leave it. And sometimes it's best to keep going. And I can work very late into the night and I can go without meals. It just depends a lot. And interestingly enough, I think the tape's passed, but I'll say. But when I was in my beginning my PhD program, I was talking to a dancer. We were both working on creativity. And she was a married woman with a couple kids, and I was married with a small child at the time. And we both were trying to express this feeling of joy in the actual process of creating. And neither one of us wanted to say it, but we both finally agreed, hey, that's it. You actually get to the point like it's like a lover. And you really almost leave the person that's with you because you're so busy with this creative part that's going, and that's, it's hard to express that to someone, but it's part of it. It's part of that.
Addiction.
Pardon?
That would be the addiction.
The what?
That would be the addiction, wouldn't it?
Well, I have the same problem when I'm in a play. I will get so involved with the cast, the characters, the story of the play, and I go home and here's my husband and children, and I look around and where do they come from? It's just not part of my world anymore.
Yeah. So it's something that is so exciting. I relate it, I suppose, to someone. Oh, I've been on the mission field in for about a year, and so there's negative and positive things to the statement. But there are people that are so involved that I almost, in some ways, become a missionary with this total involvement of working with this canvas, and it's just totally consuming. And I have to step back, I have to step away, because I am a person who relates, I am a social being, I am involved in a relationship. So that's also another part of the discipline. And accepting things of having, wanting a family, and giving myself to that too. It's a difficult thing. Okay, it's difficult to be. I think one of the things we said at another time is it's difficult to live with an artist, or it's difficult to be one. But it's difficult to live with one. I think it probably is very difficult to live with a prophet. You know.
Well, you certainly put creativity into words better than any I've ever heard it done before.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. I think that's about our hour. We can stay and talk more. The next session is Imaging the Unnameable. And that is really a very difficult subject. And I think the way I want to handle it is more of us working together as far as thinking and talking about what does that mean and how often we use givens that don't fit what we really feel. This relates, I think, to especially women in patriarchal religion, that it's very difficult to create images today because we are so involved in what we've been told the images are. It's hard to create out of givens, or to create beside givens and create newness. But that's how it evolves. That's how it evolves. Okay?
I was just going to say that I would think that this would be very complimentary to have both people in a field that has to be, because both of you need lots of space. He needs lots of space to write. He can't
have. We have a very fiery relationship.
Volatile.
As long as you both understand that it works.
Well, it also helps because you sort of understand each other.
Yeah. I would say that it's more important to have one still in the room.
Yeah.
But you're really both need lots of time.
Yeah.
Pete Moon was married to a Cherokee and he called her Married Life the Indian War.
Okay, well,
was
thank
it
you.
A session, Janet, that you, or was it Judy, that was going to do something about that personality? Two words, what's it called?
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I think that was Judith.
No.
I think so. This personality test that you can take to find out where you're.
Oh,
I
was.
That was Judith.
Yeah.
Well,
I have a hard time with tests. They box you. Thank you. All right, thank you.